and welcome to another edition of Big Mouth, where we vigorously pat down the latest developments in music, TV, books and film to see if they're hiding anything interesting in their pockets. My name is Andrew Harrison, and joining me this week are our two special guests. Writer Laura Snapes is a contributing editor to Pitchfork, a regular contributor to The Guardian and The Observer, and a total fiend for listening to The National. She is at the very cutting edge of new bands, and as her Tumblr page says, you heard it through the Snape vine. Later she'll be giving us some excellent Snape chat. Hello Laura, what have you been up to lately? What have you been discovering this week?
This week I have been discovering a country singer called Brandy Clark, who's very good. I interviewed her for The Guardian, and also a young singer-songwriter from Brooklyn called Mitski, who's also excellent, who makes kind of angsty indie songs for grown-ups.
Angsty indie songs for grown-ups.
Yes.
Well, grown-ups have angst too, so yeah. That's good. Also with us, we have Ted Kessler, features editor of Q magazine, and also the author stroke editor of the fascinating new book, My Old Man, Tales of Our Fathers. My Old Man started out as a website where various interesting people could write what they'd never actually be able to say to their dad's faces. Their stories are often affectionate, occasionally shocking, they're always revealing, and always dead interesting. It has mutated into live events at literature festivals, and now a very handsome book featuring contributions from many writers who will be familiar to Big Mouth listeners. Also, Florence Machine, Rod Stewart, Paul Weller, and the sons of Ian Dury, Leonard Cohen, and Johnny Ball. Ted is now touring this book like it is a hit album, and we'll be talking about it in detail a little bit later. Hello, Ted.
I'm doing two shows, I think, maybe three. But yeah, I will. I guess that's a tour, isn't it?
It is a limited tour,
okay,
yeah.
Very limited, yeah.
Is the life of touring misery and vans and motorway service stations agreeing with you?
Hasn't started yet.
Okay.
But I'm ready for it.
Excellent. And as ever, ensuring that we have Madison Square Garden sound quality on a Live at the Leeds Duchess of York budget, it's Matt Hall. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Andrew.
What have you been up to this week?
Mainly lying in bed.
Okay, because you're...
Because I'm ill, not because I'm really lazy, but have been ill. I am quite lazy.
It could go either way, couldn't
it?
Okay, well, the major news story this week was the death, sadly unexpected, of Muhammad Ali at the age of 74. Ali was an inspirational figure way beyond his status as possibly the greatest heavyweight champion boxer of all time. His outrageous wit and taunting of opponents broke every convention of what was expected of sportsmen in the 60s. His political awakening, conversion to Islam, and refusal to be drafted to fight in the Vietnam War were crucial to the black rights movement in the 60s and beyond. Before we do that, here's an example of how Ali inspired the world of music. You know the song, but probably not this version. Here is Muhammad Ali, Black Superman, by the great Jamaican artist Derek Morgan.
I am the greatest. I don't hate pork, and that ain't no joke. Muhammad, Muhammad Ali. He floats like a butterfly and stings like a bee. Muhammad, that black soul.
That was Muhammad Ali, Black Superman, by Derek Morgan, one of the contemporaries of Jimmy Cliff and Desmond Dekker. There's a whole catalogue of reggae records paying tribute to Muhammad Ali, but he clearly inspired rap personas like LL Cool J in his Mama Said Knock You Out phase. He's mentioned on tracks by 50 Cent, T.I., Will Smith, and he's even on Rapper's Delight. You see, I got more clothes than Muhammad Ali, and I dress so viciously. Ali's braggadocio and witty rhymes are pure rap, but it's his sense of humour that made him beloved. Laura, what did Muhammad Ali mean in music? I mean, we've seen a lot about him as a kind of a role model, as politically and socially. What did he mean in music?
I think, like you say, the way that he declared himself the greatest, I think that's been a really important message, obviously, that's kind of filtered through hip-hop. Just kind of showing a different paradigm of what a young black man could be, I think, especially.
Yeah. Ted, what was your take on Ali as a pop culture figure as opposed to a sporting figure?
I have absolutely no take on him whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I had to read quite a lot about him. And when I was reading about him, I got stuck on Rod Liddell's article for The Spectator at the weekend. Oh. And I can't get past that. In discussing him, I don't want to sound like Rod Liddell. Because
right.
Can I read you a little bit of it?
If you wish, you can, yes.
I printed out, I was reading it, and there's nowhere else to go with it. Yeah, so Rod Liddell, The Spectator. Yeah. A question for all of you of a certain age. Who was the first articulate black person you ever saw or heard? Mm. That's how it begins. Mm. And I feel that as a middle-aged white man who grew up when Muhammad Ali was not allowed to box and then became and then had a comeback, I feel even discussing him, I feel like Rod Liddell. And anything I say about him is slightly Liddell-esque. I can talk about the hip-hop influence, I suppose, but I'm not really aware that he did do that.
Mm.
It already existed, the hip-hop.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there's quite a lot of people have been writing about how basically Ali was the father, not of the sound of hip-hop, but certainly of the persona.
Yeah.
That, like, what you do is you go out and you declare yourself. You go out and you say, the first thing you say is, I'm the greatest, and then you go on to prove it. That it was, you know, a lot of black writers have been saying how this was, you know, what modern black manhood ought to be incarnated on the global stage, on the celebrity stage for the first time. And I suppose we can't understand that because, you know, we've grown up white people in a white world and you're surrounded by people you'd like to be. You can say it's a, you know, pick and mix. You can choose your role model from anywhere. True. But if you are growing up in, you know, a world where there is not that much to look up to, then to see an amazing success like this guy who doesn't compromise himself at all, that's going to feed into music as well as into politics.
Yeah, but I grew up in a world where hip-hop artists were already doing that. Mm. So, I mean, you know, I grew up in a world where Chuck D was doing that.
And yeah.
It was already existing. So I suppose they were influenced by...
What you're saying, Ted, is you're younger than me. That's what you're saying.
But I'm talking about only about a year, though, Andrew. This is why I can't believe this conversation is happening.
Well, I don't know, Matt.
I think the interesting thing is the really famous photo of the Beatles and Cassius Clay, as was, in the ring, and he's kind of punching and they're all pretending to fall down.
Yeah.
There was a Radio 4 documentary a few years ago by John Wilson, who actually kind of went and analysed that photo and went back to Miami, where the ballroom was, where Cassius Clay, as was training. And you see that image now and you think, you know, two of the most famous groups of five of the most famous people ever in the world.
Mm.
It actually was really difficult to get the Beatles to go to that venue because Clay was completely unknown at that point. He wasn't the champion.
Mm.
He was kind of well known in boxing circles, but not in the kind of wider media, or wider world. And whereas the Beatles were, obviously, they were in the States at the first time. They'd just done kind of Sullivan and all that kind of stuff. And it was, you know, they were the hot thing. And it was their PR officer who was going, you know, I think this would be quite good because he was a boxing, bit of a boxing fan. And the Beatles were like, oh, God, do we have to do this? Do we really have to do this? Who is this bloke anyway? And he gets down there. They get down there. And, of course, Clay being Clay, Muhammad Ali being Muhammad Ali, as far as he's concerned, they are the ones in the presence of greatness rather than an unknown boxer who's been deigned on for 5 minutes. And I think that attitude right from the start was something that that kind of made him special. And I think you look at that. You know, you look at those press conferences. There was lots on the TV, lots of the archive footage. The press conferences of those kind of fights against kind of Joe Frazier and stuff, and you can see two different types of black male expression on either side of the guy hosting the press conference. You know, there's Ali, kind of smart, pretty, looking everyone in the eye, and then on the other side there's kind of Frazier, who is, you know, a much more kind of physically solid, much more kind of traditional kind of heavyweight stereotype.
Yeah.
And just that, the way that changed, the way that he changed that, I thought was really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, obviously everybody loves you when you've just died, and you know, the long, you know, sad period was a bit, you know, agonizing to look at when he was suffering from Parkinson's disease and still going around the world and, you know, making appearances, doing what he could for the cause that he believed in. But there was also a, you know, kind of a dark side to the Ali brand, I suppose we'd call it now. You know, he called Joe Frazier an Uncle Tom when Joe Frazier wasn't an Uncle Tom. He was just another black man with a different approach.
The whole Bumbaye thing as well. You know, basically that wasn't very nice saying that you were going to go and kill somebody.
Yeah, just,
you
know, absolutely. Yeah,
in a boxing match.
Yeah,
and that's the kind of thing that when somebody does that now in the warm up to a fight, people get really quite
an inquiry,
disturbed about it, you know, saying, look, this is a sport, you shouldn't be doing that. And he was getting kind of like 20,000 Africans to chant it in a stadium, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And also, you know, there's the fact, you know, he did project himself as, you know, he would say, I am the, you know, the sum of white men's fears. I'm, you know, I'm here to terrify, I'm the baddest around. You know, you could say that was playing up to a kind of, you know, actually worsening a racist stereotype. You know, that it's not breaking anything down, it's reinforcing something. And of course, you know, fighting in the Philippines and Zaire, where you've got basically two murderous dictatorships, you know, it wasn't all this...
Nobody's
perfect, exactly, yeah. But if this was, you know, would we be applauding it if it happened now? If you know, somebody burst onto the scene with that kind of, like, I am the baddest character around, and I'm here to terrify you.
Yeah, but doing it with it, yeah, but... He wasn't just saying that. He was doing it with a charm and a glint in his eye and that kind of, you know, sophisticated kind of patter that made everybody go, actually, that's quite... I was listening to I Am the Greatest album, the kind of spoken word album of his poetry that I think we're going to play something of. And it's kind of quite strange because it was recorded when he was Cassius Clay. And it was recorded, I think, kind of in front of an audience. And the similarities between the way that the audience respond to him and the way that the audience respond to when you listen to those kind of... the Rat Pack at the Sands.
Yeah.
It's quite similar. You know, there's kind of like... obviously quite drunk people in the audience cackling at kind of people being at somebody on stage being slick and smart and kind of dissing their opponents. Yeah.
Well, should we have a quick listen to that now? Here's a track from Ali's own album released in 1963. This is the title track and the album is called What Else? I Am the Greatest.
Cassius Clay, the most beautiful fighter in the world today. He talks a great deal and brags indeedy of a muscular punch that's incredibly speedy. This brash young boxer is something to see and the heavyweight championship.
Cassius Clay, as was with I Am the Greatest. There really had never been anyone in boxing who understood the value of the smart one-liner like Ali. I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean I make medicine sick. I'm so fast that last night I turned off the light switch and I was in bed before the room was dark. These are the things that can get requoted in obituaries. Anyway, right, it's Let's Look at Masculinity Week here on Big Mouth because our guest, Ted Kessler, has a new book out in which various writers, famous and civilian, reminisce about their fathers. Mm. In a minute, we'll talk about the book and how our dad's taste in music affects or doesn't affect ours. But first, here's the song that gave Ted's book its title. This is Ian Dury and My Old Man.
My old man wore three-piece whistles. He was never home for long. Drove a bus for London Transport. He knew where he belonged. Number 18 down to Euston. Double-decker, move along. Double-decker, move.
Ian Dury and My Old Man from New Boots and Panties back in 1977. Ian Dury's daughter Jemima is actually in the book with quite a poignant piece about her dad. Ted, this is a fascinating and, you know, slightly eye-misting read.
But what, good, I'm glad.
But what got you doing it? How did it happen?
Okay, so I suppose it started with that song when I was a nipper. I'd just left home. I was about 17 and I was living a long way away from my own family and I heard that song at a house party, one night at the end of a house party, and it sort of just got me, and I thought, God, that is a lovely, ruminative, melancholic tune. I wonder if one day I could do something like that, and I forgot about it. And then many years later, you know, I'm just wondering if perhaps I could do something beyond being a music journalist, just as a hobby, and I could write about my dad who was approaching 80. And as he approached 80, I wrote just a piece about that and I thought, where can I put this? And I don't want to send it to a magazine because I don't want someone else to edit it. I don't want it like to be renosed. I don't want to pitch it to a supplement. Maybe I'll just put it on a blog and do it myself.
Yeah.
Did that. Asked a couple of people I know to also consider doing it. Two or three things went up. Then it just became a rolling stone that gathered plenty of moss. And it seemed to touch a nerve, people writing about their dads.
Do you think it might be because it's very hard to talk straight to anybody finds it hard to talk eye to eye with their dad because talking means feelings and feelings are bad. You shouldn't have feelings, but it's actually better to write it down. You can communicate more that way.
I certainly find that generally. I mean, that's how I do most of the stuff. I find that I can write it much better than I can talk it. I guess that's definitely true. I mean, I think perhaps men of a certain generation find it particularly hard to talk. I don't know, maybe modern dads find it easier.
I don't know.
No, I find it quite hard, and I'm a dad.
Which of the pieces that you got in kind of surprised you most?
Every story is surprising. I mean, apart from Paul Weller's, because I knew that inside out anyway.
Yeah.
Because I know that his dad was his manager from the age of 14, and then he stopped managing when he died, basically. So he's a manager till, you know, for 40 years, pretty much. So, but every other story was surprising. Terry White's was extraordinarily depressing. Terry White, the editor of Empire.
Explain a little bit about what happened.
Yes, I can tell you that. Her dad her dad married her mum when they were teenagers, and he just pretty much abandoned her and kept letting her down, kept breaking her heart, and they really don't communicate now. And it's just that it's a tale about how she's resolved herself to that situation. Mm. Very misty-eyed there, I think, Andrea.
Yeah. The story about Johnny Ball.
Johnny Ball's an absolute genius story,
isn't
it?
It's fantastic. I had no idea that he was such a nutter. Frankly.
He is a hoot because... I mean, the story there is that they go to see his beloved Liverpool, but they've got tickets in the Chelsea end. So the deal is they can't, whatever you do, Dad, please don't stand up and shout Liverpool. So the first thing he does when he gets into the Chelsea end is stand up and go, Liverpool, arms wide, standing up. Bad looks ensue, and then it's the snowball where they exit. By the end of it, they're ejected and covered in, drenched in spit. Although Johnny Ball is not drenched in sweat.
Yeah, because he's Johnny Ball off the telly. Yeah. It's a poor son. Yes. Yeah.
You know, he tells everyone off for swearing initially, and then they all recognise him. Of course, Johnny Ball's told me off for swearing. God. And they get thrown out. But because he's such a charmer, they get put in with the Liverpool fans, so it's a win-win. But we did a live thing a few weeks ago with Johnny and Nick, and, I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Mm. There's so many great stories that Johnny Ball has about almost killing all members of his family on various holidays. And he also had a little rejoinder to that Chelsea story. He went off. He said... Of course, I once killed a man at Chelsea. He took some guy on a week-long drinking trip, and at the end of the and they went to see Chelsea Liverpool, and the guy didn't have a hat on, and he was very, very drunk, and he just passed out and died.
Good Lord!
Next to him, yeah. So there's more of that. There's more Johnny.
So the
Ball's
lesson in that is don't go drinking with Johnny Ball.
Yeah.
Well, I took a man to Chelsea just to watch him die.
Yeah.
Laura, what? I mean, it's obviously very difficult to say. What did you think of the book in front of the guy who's put the book together and written half of it? What did it get you think about your own dad? Did you enjoy the book? Yes.
I really, really enjoyed it. I especially loved Richard Hawley's essay. I thought that was amazing. Just the way he's so full of praise for his dad, basically saying that like he's cooler than he could ever have hoped he could be. And then I won't spoil it, but it kind of turns on his admission of saying something really shameful to his dad when he's a teenager. And kind of how gracefully his dad dealt with it. It did make me think, what would I write about my dad? I've got a really, really bad memory, so I'm really still struggling to think what I actually would write. But I mean, my dad definitely got me into music, I think. Like, you know, when he would drive me to school when I was like six and I started going to a different school, and it was when he had What's the Story Morning Glory on in the car. So for
God,
a while...
God, you're so young. Stop Jesus, it. Flora. God almighty.
So for a while, that was my favourite album, but then the Spice Girls happened, and so I stopped liking cool music.
Just killed three people.
Sorry.
There's up and down the country, Big Mouth listeners are just staring into a void now going, my God. But yeah, I mean, that's that thing of like, you know, what your music, the music you grow to like, is it or is it not imprinted by your parents? And you particularly, you know, because my experience of my friends is that, like, the dads like music and the mums like the radio. Turn that racket off, you know. And, you know, in my case, my dad, you know, loves country and John Denver and stuff. And I've managed to get him into Richard Hawley, which is nice. And I think I'm thinking of getting him started on Nick Cave. Is this a good idea? I don't know.
Depends which era. They're really murderous.
They really, probably love that, yeah. Did your dad's music taste imprint upon you?
Not really, because I think once I discovered pop music and I discovered the world of writing, like, you know, not writing, but like Smash Hits and Top of the Pops magazine and things, I was very into my own thing. And he would come into the living room when I was watching Top of the Pops and be like, they're miming. And I'd be like, no, they're not. Stop trying to tear down everything I like.
When you become a dad, you get handed a sheet. This is a big secret. You get handed a sheet. And top of it, it says, sneer at whatever your children like on Top of the Pops or any other music show on TV.
Miming's good. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, miming proves anyone can do it.
But I was trying to think of what we would hear in the house growing up. He's very into U2, and I've never really liked U2. I remember once hearing Japan in the living room when I was little and just being like, what is this horrible noise? But now I quite like Japan. And the beautiful
sound... Is your dad like 25 or something? He's 3 years old. What's God?
He was 24 when I was born.
Right.
So he's 53 now.
Gross.
Oh, God.
Sorry. And The Beautiful South, that was a big one. And I remember liking that because they had swear words in, which my parents would always forget to skip in the car.
Right.
But otherwise, I think things I got from him, like, I did like Jamiroquai and I did like The Corrs. That was the first band I ever went to see live, and him and my mum took me. But it's funny, at home now, obviously I don't live there anymore, and my middle brother doesn't live there, but my youngest brother is 17. But the musical, my youngest brother doesn't care about music at all, which I find really weird. He told me he gets all his music by ripping it off YouTube. using these websites. But my dad is the music tyrant in the house. He got one of those Sonos things, and you walk in the front door, and he'll just be like pumping EDM throughout the entire house.
What?
I go home and I have to yell like, "Please, could you turn it down?" Or like Coldplay at obnoxious volumes. It drives my mum spare.
I think we've got the wrong Snape here.
I think we should get your dad on the show. Actually, get the both of you on the show Snape special, Planet of the Snapes. Ted, how did your dad's musical taste? Let's go back a few years. Your dad's musical taste.
Well, he really did imprint it on me, but I was obviously hated everything he played. But now I love it. I remember he used to play Bob Dylan in the car, and I thought it was the worst thing I'd ever heard. Age 6 or 7,
yeah,
driving around Bob Dylan, I demand he take it off, and he would play a lot of Jerry Mulligan and a lot of sort of Coltrane. I love Thelonious Monk. I love those guys now. At the time, I thought, what is this noise? But I'm obsessed by Thelonious Monk. I love John Coltrane.
But to be fair, I wouldn't put on like John Coltrane on a car journey.
He would.
Yeah, excellent. No,
he would. Yeah, yeah.
To shut you a lot up. Or to wind you a lot up.
It's just good. He also would play, and he loved Glenn Gould.
So he played
a lot of classical music. And I love Glenn Gould now too. So I think, although at the time I thought it was awful, it does imprint deeply, and they all pop up later on, and I now wear them as regularly.
Because it is every man's fate to turn into their dad.
Yeah. Oh, please.
Well, you know, in the good parts.
There's some aspects we cannot turn into.
There's some aspects we can't turn into, but some parts it's fate. You can't get away from it.
Yeah, yeah. No.
And maybe it happens with the music as well. I don't know.
I think so. I mean, I like the same music. I do the same job. I wear similar clothes. I'm the same, you know.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, I've got the same beard as well, man. Okay, well, from music that your dad likes to music that will send him running from the room, possibly, if he's the right age. This week sees the release of C87, a triple CD, 74-track compilation from the very dawn, the Triassic period of indie pop. It's a sequel to Enemy's famous cassette compilation, C86, which drew together everything shambling, jangling, studenty and pallid into one easy-to-carry-around package. C87, the CD, features artists from the relatively well-known, like The House of Love, The Shame and The Darling Buds and Could, to the thunderously obscure, like The Corn Dollies, Baby Lemonade, The Caretaker Race and inevitably Bogshed. It is a John Peel world, and it's about as far from contemporary indie rock as you could possibly get. So how do we get here from there? And should we go back there? Where was there anyway? Before we discuss this, here is some prime 1987 indie rock. This is The Wedding Present with My Favourite Dress. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm back in the university refectory in my Breton fisherman's cap and my Col Not Dole badge. That was The Wedding Present, or The Widows, as you had to call them, with the angst-ridden romance of My Favourite Dress. Laura, you're a young person. You're an indie rock person. Is this indie rock as you know it? This is possibly before you were born.
Yeah, I think it is. There are a lot of bands that sound like this around at the moment, but I didn't make it all the way through this 3-disc compilation, but listening to it just filled me with this sense of dread.
Yeah.
There's very little that's distinctive about any of it. It's just one, it sounds like it was made inside one of those old black and white TVs that you had to like tune with a knob rather than
buttons.
We did
have colour television in the 1980s and you know, hot and cold running electricity.
Yeah, but the people who were in these bands didn't have a matter of
in Leeds,
a badge of
in
honor.
Bradford.
Anywhere.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to completely undermine the whole movement because I think it's positive that it wasn't London centric and there were a lot of women involved and, you know, it kind of devalued masculinity that maybe had been a big kind of currency in indie and rock up until that point. But I don't know, you know, the C81 tape, that's really interesting. It's got a lot of different kind of exciting kinds of bands on it. C86 is kind of willfully narrow, and C87, this isn't even original cassette. It's just something that somebody's cooked up as like an imaginary kind of sequel.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm all for compilations, kind of putting together weird bits of history that people don't really remember. But if you can find me somebody who would sit through all 3 discs of that,
if this is your thing, you will be in hog heaven.
Yeah.
It's just, I wonder how many people there are.
My brother is really pleased that this has happened because he was totally into this when it came out. But B is really pissed off because he was in a really not very successful shambling indie band like this.
What were they called?
They were called the Candy Darlings, of course.
Obviously.
And he's just totally bemused about why he's the only band that he knows from that era that hasn't had a call to be put on a compilation like this, because everything else has been swept up.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff on here I'd never heard of. There's Cud demos on here.
And I was talking to him yesterday about saying we were doing this, and I said, man, even the Raw Herbs are on this. And he said, yeah, we went to see the Raw Herbs in Manchester. I said, did we? He goes, yeah, do you remember? It was that night we went to see the Raw Herbs and then we went to the Hacienda. I remember the Hacienda as clear as day. Funnily enough, the Raw Herbs has completely slipped from my memory.
Why have you got such a crystal clear memory of the Hacienda?
Because one was life-affirming and brilliant and futuristic, and another was a load of sad boys with fringes shambling around in Breton shirts.
Ted, were you a sad boy in a fringe shambling around in a Breton shirt?
I absolutely was not. Okay. I hated this music at the time. Mm.
What did you hate about it?
I hated the amateurism of it. I hated the lack of ambition. I hated the small-minded, just unsexiness of it. Mm. And I really liked going nightclubbing in 1987, and this would not be played in a nightclub.
I looked up yesterday. I put in dance music, 1987.
Yeah.
So much good stuff.
It's a golden era.
And just... like literally, Mars, Pump Up the Volume, CC Rogers, Someday, Sterling Void, It's All Right, Future Acid Tracks, Bomb the Bass, Beat This, Eric B. and Racket in Paid in Full, plus all the kind of Jackson Sisters, I Believe in Miracles reissues and stuff as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know what, Matt? You could have had, let me get it open if I can get the bloody iPhone to work. You could have had, you know, the Heartthrobs or the Boy Hairdressers or the Nivens or the Bachelor Pad.
Or the Dentists.
Or the Dentists.
Ever named a band The Dentists?
But you see, I was
hip hop in 87. This was the first Public Enemy album, and
there was all that
Scooby
stuff
D and all that.
So, and it was all
why
fantastic.
Would you bother?
Well, the thing is, this wasn't my stuff at the time, and I still find it pretty hard work. But in an attempt to give it a fair shake in this pretty cruel panel here, you've got to give them this. You've got to give them this. It was not. It didn't have that kind of greedy need for affirmation and need to be big and need to be massive. You know, it was clearly kind of, you know, it was a parochial world. It was an NME world. It was before, you know, the Stone Roses had come along with the notion that you declare yourself to be huge and therefore you are, which has had terrible consequences as well as some good consequences. So you can go, you know, it's got things going for it.
The Stone Roses were a reaction to it, I think, very much so.
And also the Stone Roses had been out to those kind of clubs that Ted was in.
Yeah.
And that's why the Stone Roses sounded different and sounded funkier and more interesting.
There's a whole argument about funkier and more interesting we may have at another time. But
I also think they're the kind of the opposite of what you were saying about, you know, they didn't want to be big. They're the kind of bands that I feel took kind of valorization in being small, and I think that's just as much of a stupid mindset. I'd much rather look at a pop star who wants to be some kind of behemoth rather than somebody who's willfully like, oh no, you can't sell out by putting something on Fierce Panda.
Yeah, there is that immensely tedious kind of India than thou and small than thou thing.
I think it's called the Stephen Pastel syndrome.
Yeah.
The Stephen Pastel syndrome. So how does this relate to our contemporary landfill indie where, you know, you've got bands that are kind of reiterating the same stuff 30 years later?
I don't know that I would draw a line between that and like landfill indie, because I think what we think of as landfill indie is a lot more boisterous and has a lot more of a sense of its own, you know, goodness.
Actually, that is one thing that you can say for this stuff on C87. It is not proper indie for the lads. It's not leery and beery. It's asexual.
But it was very consciously asexual, wasn't it? It was very consciously kind of sweet, giving girls kind of your last kind of Rolo if you fancied them type of thing. It wasn't there was no kind of oi oi.
Yeah.
And as much also as I think that it's good that there was so much female involvement in the scene and it's not that kind of boorish macho thing, you know, there's definitely a line from C87 kind of stuff to Band Sebastian and that really cloying, like, fetishization of, like, cute librarian girls in polka dots and thick glasses.
I think if you were a female, you weren't allowed into an indie club in 86, 87 unless you had a little kind of a...
barrette.
Either a barrette or a little kind of hair clip with a teddy bear on
it. And a conspicuous Penguin classic in your hand.
Yes. But I think the scene that it does link to today, which is really interesting, there's a little group of bands kind of coming out of New York, I think, and a few years ago, a bunch of them grouped together and did this band camp project where they were all just, I think they all had to record a song every day. And so there's acts like Frankie Cosmos and Level Up and Porches and Japanese Breakfast, which do have that kind of...
Japanese Breakfast.
Yes.
Excellent.
She's really, really good. Like, it's dream pop with actual like melodies and choruses. And they're making things that are like very self-consciously small and kind of domestic and self-deprecating about their lot in life. But that's quite interesting. It doesn't have the kind of we've got to stay small mentality. Yeah. It's just kind of, I don't know, an interesting eye on humdrum existences.
I suppose not being familiar with Miss Breakfast's work, but I can see that at the moment it actually would be quite, if you know, if you're starting out, it'd be quite tempting just to contrast yourself completely with the Dayglo achievement oriented, we're going to be massive, you know, main stageness of pop at the moment. There'd be something quite punk rock about wanting to play in the tiniest place with the tiniest instruments.
Maybe. I mean, I don't even know if it's a reaction, because I feel like a lot of those bands probably really like pop music. Like Michelle, who is Japanese Breakfast, I think she said she'd love to write for somebody like Rihanna. But I think a lot of this music has come about because of the very limited means these people have, living in expensive shoeboxes in New York. So all they've got is like a guitar and a little amp, and they can't make that much noise because they'd get complaints.
There you go, Japanese Breakfast in expensive shoeboxes. can you imagine some hot young Pitchfork type just finding the C87 box set and being inspired?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think that influence is still really, really big. Like if you look at a band like Div, however you say it, terrible band, there's all this sound, it's just like, you know, black and white static washing machine kind of guitar, the same thing just like twanging away. I'm not for it. Down with that sort of thing.
Fair dues. Well, if you want an idea of how closely the C86 sound was entwined with the music press, here's another track from C87. This is the Chesterfields and Ask Johnny D.
Well, if you'd like to know what pop stars have for tea, ask Johnny D and in which motorcar it's safe.
That was the Chesterfields and Ask Johnny D, immortalising the music writer Johnny D. Hello, Johnny, if you're listening. You're listening to Big Mouth with me, Andrew Harrison, plus Matt Hall, and our special guests, author of the book My Old Man, Ted Kessler. Hello again, Ted.
Hello.
And from Pitchfork and The Guardian, the music writer, Laura Snapes. Hello, Laura Snapes.
Hello, Andrew Harrison.
How are you doing? So we've done dads this week, and now let's turn to mums with BBC2's sitcom Mum. It features the great actress Leslie Manville, part of Mike Lee's company, as Kathy, a recently widowed suburban housewife who's trying to make sense of her changed world. Instead of coming together to support her, her family makes things worse. Her daft son brings his useless girlfriend Kelly into the house. Kathy's brother keeps bringing his appalling snobby new partner Pauline around to cheer her up. And neighbour Michael is clearly in love with Kathy, but just can't bring himself to make a move. It's very gentle stuff, but it's not remotely sentimental. Laura, what did you make of it?
I was surprised at how much I enjoy it. I never watch these kind of BBC comedy things, mostly not for any snobby reasons, just because I have limited time to watch TV. But the first 10 minutes, I was very unsure of where it was going or what kind of show it was going to be.
Yeah.
But I did, like you say, it's not sentimental. There's something a bit weird and unsettling about it. And it's not... I couldn't think of many other kind of family-oriented dramas I'd seen like that. It reminded me a bit of Hebben, the great Vic Reeves singer, got cancelled after 2 seasons.
Yeah.
But I thought it was all very affecting, very moving. And when the daft girlfriend character first comes in, I thought, this is going to be ridiculous. But actually, there's a lot of humanity in that character.
Yeah.
The only one that I really don't like is Pauline. I feel like the trajectory, I've seen 2 episodes, I think the trajectory of that character is going to be really predictable. She's a boring snob. She kind of admits to being a bit lonely. Obviously, they're going to end up being like friends, or she's going to have some kind of emotional breakthrough. But she's just too broadly drawn, I think.
I don't know about the emotional breakthrough. I think this is the kind of show where people don't change. I think it's the kind of show where people's characters are their characters and you're stuck with them. But I think you're right about the fact that it's, you know, this is not My Family on BBC One. This is not a heartwarmer at all. And there's these really heartbreaking moments where poor Kathy is trying to, you know, like on the day of her husband's funeral, trying to keep everybody happy and trying to put up with their appalling foibles. And every couple of scenes, you'll see her just like sitting on the wall outside the house having a fag, just destroyed, completely, you know, grey and just broken, and then having to put her face back on and go back inside. But it's got some immensely funny moments, I think, particularly Kelly, who you think is going to be just an archetypal sitcom ditz. But she has these great lines, like they say to the dead husband's parents, well, it's awful, nobody expects to have to bury their own child. And Kelly says, yeah, you'd think they'd have somebody to do that for you, wouldn't you?
And also when she comes to the funeral and she's not wearing pants, or she's wearing an appropriate
pants. She's forgotten to wear knickers.
Yeah, and she has to ask Kathy to wear a pair of knickers. And she's like, does this happen often? And she's like, oh yeah, all the time.
Can I borrow a pair of knickers?
Yeah.
Ted, what did you make of Mom? Gab expert Ted. Mom.
I think there are, I agree, there's some good lines and it's quite funny, but I think it lays it on too thick. There's too many jokes. It would have been funny if less jokes and it would have been funny if less characters in it all the time.
Yeah.
They're always at the house. They're always hanging around at the house. Surely she'd just say, can you leave me some peace, please? Can I be alone?
But isn't that her tragedy that she's the mom and it's her job to facilitate for everybody?
Yeah.
Even when her husband's died and she's feeling completely broken.
I get
that,
but I think she's smarter than all the other characters and she could just work that one out. I'd feel like that it was slightly too contrived and I think perhaps it would work better if there was less going on constantly.
Maybe.
It felt like it was packing a lot into a half hour sitcom.
I mean, the conceit is that each show represents a different month.
Yeah.
And you see her kind of getting through it. You go to January funeral, February Valentine's Day, then it's May, and then things progress. But isn't it in the same tradition as the royal family? You could imagine in the royal family that Sheila would at some point say, "Get out of the house,
totally.
Leave me alone."
But in the royal family, there's quite a lot of silence as well. Mm. There are moments where they're just watching TV for a few minutes, and that would actually impart a lot within those moments. Whereas this is always something going on. There's always a joke being lined up. And I just feel they could just dial that down. Also, the characters are too one-dimensional for me. I mean, the royal family did have one-dimensional characters, but there was more nuance to them there. There's no nuance at all to these characters.
I mean, I think with
apart from the mum.
Yeah, I think the thing with the royal family is that it was actually kind of quite genre break. It put loads of stuff in there that you'd never seen before, like people just sat around watching TV.
Yeah.
And all of the characters were strong enough that there wasn't really a star. You know, they all had movement around them. Not one of them was the central character. Whereas this, there's one character that's been given emotional depth and being allowed to kind of to respond to other characters, where there's, all the others are very kind of one-dimensional. I just think, and I think what you were saying, Laura, about moving on, the whole point of the traditional sitcom is that, as with kind of Steptoe and Son, nothing ever changes.
Yeah.
You know, characters change within the episode, and then by the end of the episode, they're right back where they were, where they started, so that it starts again afresh. Yeah. Now, that's kind of changed over the last kind of few decades, but even so, I just think this doesn't work as a sitcom. Having said that, I think it's quite interesting that the BBC is doing this, targeting what is obviously a kind of a more mature audience and a more kind of mainstream audience.
Well, it's essentially a Mike Lee domestic, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of like there's not really a plot as such. There's nobody's striving towards anything. They're just rumbling through their days. And I thought Leslie Manville was fantastic in Another Year, where she plays this woman who has kind of refused to grow up to such a point at which everyone else has kind of left her behind. And the final scene is absolutely heartbreaking. She's just like sat in the kitchen on her own, wondering where the fun has gone. And this is a kind of to me, that's like a slight refraction of that character.
I thought that's exactly what I thought when I was watching, actually, and I compared to Another Year. She's much more neurotic in that, though, isn't she? That final scene, her face just twitching.
Yeah.
It's the internal thought process. It's amazing. I agree, yeah.
She is brilliant.
Yeah.
Mum is still running, and if you're quick, I think you can still catch episode one on iPlayer, but you'll be able to at least catch up on the rest of them. Okay, we are nearing the end of the show, and it's time for closing time chatter. This is when we ask our guests for the incredibly interesting thing that they want to pass on this week, that thing that's been burning a hole in their brain. Laura, I believe you have something to say about the 3 Feet High and Rising review. Tell us about it.
Yes. So MTV News the American side of it, has recently revitalized this amazing cultural hub. So many incredible writers there. And they have a lot of young critics as well, which I think is really important. And one of them last week wrote an article about listening to 3 Feet High and Rising for the first time. He's called David Turner. He's 24. He's a young black guy. And he was very dismissive about it. He kind of does a play-by-play, minutes by minutes. And he drops in a lot about, going to yoga class and eating a bagel and just really not being into it. He writes,
And decides that it's no major laser.
He decides it's no major laser, yeah. And he writes things like, too often going that far back can feel like a chore. It makes Drake's Views from the Six sound like a Ramones EP because he thinks it's too long. Anyway, it was kind of, classic clickbait. I didn't think the article was that remarkable. It's kind of an interesting comment, I guess, on how younger generations are meant to kind of reabsorb, absorb a dictated canon.
Yeah.
But the response to it was insane.
People got really pissed off, didn't they?
Really angry. I was looking through his Twitter mentions yesterday, and it's like, borderline death threats. People are so angry about how dismissive he's been. Yeah, the American Observer newspaper wrote a really long article about it, and they accused him of blind generationalism and possibly the worst case of clickbait contrarianism in music journalism history, which shows they're, wow. they're not reading NME.com very
they
much.
They aren't, no.
And also the journalist from The Observer interviewed De La Soul about it, and they said, well, he's obviously clowning, but I wasn't kind of personally offended by it.
That's some heavy meta going on there. Yeah. Articles about articles, and we're doing a podcast yeah. about an article about an article.
Yeah.
And space is folding in upon itself.
And then the former New Yorker pop critic, Sacha Fred Jones, he wrote a really long essay about it as well. He was saying, like, you know, he brought his consciousness to the material reality of 3 Feet High and Rising, a recording that, like all of them, has to make its bones on merit, not hobble into your house on the basis of stars and points and liner notes. We already have those reviews. Why would we want them again? Which I think is a fair point. You know, I think fundamentally the original article is it's a bit weak, but it didn't really offend me. I kind of read it and moved on. But it shows something really interesting, I think, about people. It's older music critics' insecurity about the
We're
things
not
they
insecure.
Value.
Stop it.
The things they value being respected or disrespected by a younger yeah. generation. And I just thought that whole discussion was hilarious.
You'll feel that about
strange.
Sleater Kinney one day when someone re-reviews Sleater Kinney.
That's true. Yeah.
Somebody as yet in their pram. What got me about that story was just like, I was just really annoyed by his style as kind of showing how wacky he was and, you know, how the old stuff is so old. Mm-hmm. Got me nerves. I just don't understand. How could anybody not like 3 Feet High and Rising? It's one of the most likable records.
Yeah, it's pretty joyful.
It went on for too long, apparently. It had too many skits.
Whatever. Ted.
I mean, on vinyl, it was a real disappointment to me at the time because it was so hard to get a proper volume out of it.
So much of it.
Yeah, I worked in a record shop when it came out. We used to play it and we could not hear it properly compared to the 12 inches when they came in. They sounded magnificent. Yeah. So, but that's the only time I've been disappointed by it whatsoever. It's a magnificent record. But I don't mind if someone doesn't like it. I've never liked Led Zeppelin. That's a sacred cow. I hate Led Zeppelin.
Me neither.
I could review it when I was 18 and hate it. I'm now slightly older than that, and I still hate Led Zeppelin. And so I think there's some things people don't get, and that's fine. I'm not even sure it's a generational thing. It's just your ears. It's your taste.
Ted, if this secret that like some people like some things and other people like other things ever gets out, the music industry journalism is doomed, or even more doomed than it already is.
But you have to contextualise it, don't you? That's the skill.
Absolutely, that's the skill. What's your own closing time chatter, Ted?
Well, I interviewed Billy Childish last week, the musician, painter, writer, etc. And whenever I have met him in the past, you always leave feeling slightly brainwashed. And this time, he imparted the line that creativity is the heart and soul of mankind. And I went away thinking, that is a lovely feeling, and it's true. And he explained that success is not when you actually sell anything; it's when you actually make something. And I just wanted to share that amongst people, having done that, having made my book. That the most successful part of it was actually finishing it.
Yeah,
and that's what we should all aim to make some stuff.
We should. Well, people should also buy your book because that would be more satisfying.
I'd also feel some satisfaction with the £1 million.
Excellent.
Account, yes,
Matt, what's your closing time chatter?
Only that I've been not very well this week, so I've been reverting to my comfort blankets, and they are a series of books by Peter O'Donnell, who wrote the Modesty Blaze newspaper strip, but he also wrote a number of novels starring the same characters, and I'm often intrigued. And I think it was a few years ago Quentin Tarantino was kind of looking to buy the rights to do a proper film of the series, and it's quite an interesting why people are talking now about who's going to be the new James Bond, and I think that it's a real missed opportunity for there not to have been a really decent Modesty Blaze film with a strong kind of female kick-ass character.
Excellent. Okay, well, my closing time chatter is that this week I got to have a very tiny role in the world of Star Wars, which is very exciting. I hosted the launch at Abbey Road for the new holographic vinyl edition of the Force Awakens soundtrack, and it is genuinely amazing thing because it's a piece of vinyl and you shine a light on it and you can see a Millennium Falcon hovering in three dimensions within the vinyl. You want to like reach in and touch it, and the other piece has got a TIE fighter and it feels real and it's revolving around, and it's a genuinely cool kind of eye-defying thing. And the holograms are handmade. This guy, Tristan, has to hand etch the master.
He's called Tristan, is he?
He is, yeah. And he's a really nice guy.
Why does that not surprise me?
He did a 3D hologram vinyl thing for Jack White, obviously, because Jack White has to have all the new vinyl things. But it just got me thinking, you know, this is like, vinyl is clearly an objet d'art. It's not just the thing that plays music. And, you know, anything that can make vinyl more beautiful and more lovely and more collectible, then I am all for it. And I want to have my back collection of Star Wars soundtracks, each with an individual.
Etched.
etched. I want
personally etched I by
want,
Tristan.
I want Princess Leia hovering above the Episode 4 New Hope soundtrack, telling me that I'm her only hope. So that's our show. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks to our guests, Laura Snapes, thank you for coming. Ted Kessler, thanks for coming. Remember, you can hear the show again on our Audio Boom page. Go to audioboom.com and search for Big Mouth. We've also got interesting actual features on these and other subjects at our, via our Facebook page. You can go follow us at facebook.com/BigMouthUK. And you can subscribe to our podcast via iTunes. Just go to podcasts and search for Big Mouth. Thanks again for listening. We'll be here again next week. And yeah, see you then. Bye.